I think after Ernie's opening, I could call that a message and we could just sit down and think about that. I was at a funeral earlier this week, and it's good to go be reminded that this life we're living is going to come to an end one of these days. It's not something that we necessarily want to always think about, but it's something everybody's going to face, and it does us good to be reminded of that. All right, that's not what I'm going to preach about, but I do thank you for the reminder, Ernie. I titled the message, What to Do with Imaginations. We all have an imagination this morning. And I'm curious, you don't have to answer this out loud, but I'm curious whether you think of it as a positive or a negative thing in your mind. Is it a good or is it a bad thing? Webster's definition is forming a mental image of something not present to the senses and never wholly perceived. So what do you think of imaginations? Are they good or are they bad? God gave us these amazing things all of us have in our heads, and they're called brains. And he gives us the ability to reason and to think. And we're really the only one of God's creations that have the ability to think and reason to the extent that we do. I know there's really intelligent animals out there, and sometimes we could maybe even argue they're smarter than us in some ways, and some of them are. Obviously, a dog can smell better than I can. And so there's some senses they may be sharper in. But overall, man can always outthink and outreason an animal. We have that God-given ability in all of us. Now, I always viewed imagination as a positive thing, and I still do. I'm not here to squelch anybody's imagination this morning, especially in children. I like to see the imagination in children. I like to see the creativeness of an imagination in a child. It's amazing what all they can come up with. And it's amazing, too, what adults can come up with. But as I was studying for this message, I was struck by this. Listen to this. The word imagination is found 14 times in the Bible. And 10 of those, the word evil is in the exact same verse. And 3 of those mentions either a proud heart or walking after our own heart or lifting ourselves up. There's only one time it's used in a positive way, and that was in a prayer of David that David was praying for Solomon. So now what are we going to do with imagination? Now there is also the word imaginations, if you want to get technical, and it's mentioned 6 times. And once more, 4 of those times it was talked about in a negative way. 1 time we're instructed how to use it. And 1 other time was mentioned in a prayer of David also. There's not a lot of positive the Bible actually talks about when it talks about our imaginations. So why would God give us this thing that we all face, all can use, and it has so much potential for downside? And what are we supposed to do with it? Are we not supposed to have a vision? Are we not supposed to dream together with our spouses? And I want to say it's good for a church to get together and imagine where we can be in 10 years. It's good for a spouse to sit down and talk about a vision for our children and our future. Those aren't bad things. But it's definitely something we need to be aware of and control, or else it easily can spin into places we don't need it to go. We're going to talk about a man. I heard a form of this message preached, I think it was by an evangelist years ago, We're going to talk about Naaman this morning. We're going to read from 2 Kings 5. This man nearly got himself in trouble with his imagination. I'm going to read, we'll just read the story. I'll try to read it quickly, the first 19 verses of it. There's a lot of things we could get out of here, but we'll just read the story for a base. Verse 1, 2 Kings 5. Now Naaman, the captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master, and honorable, because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria, and he was also a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. And the Syrians had gone out by companies and brought away the captive out of the land of Israel, a little maid, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And she said unto her mistress, "Would God that my lord there were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he would recover him of his leprosy." And one went in and told his lord, saying, "Thus and thus said the maid that is of the land of Israel." And the king of Syria said, Go, and I will send a letter unto the king of Israel." And he departed, and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 pieces of gold, and 10 changes of raiment. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, "Now when this letter is come unto thee, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman my servant to thee, that thou mayest recover him of his leprosy." And it came to pass, when the king of Israel read the letter, that he rent his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man doth send unto me to recover a man of his leprosy? Wherefore consider, I pray you, and see how he seeketh a quarrel against me." And it was so, when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, "Wherefore hast thou rent thy clothes? Let him come now to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and his chariot, and stood at the door of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, "Go and wash in Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come again to thee, and thou shalt be clean." But Naaman was wroth, and went away, and said, "Behold, I thought he will surely come out to me, and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, and strike his hand over the place and recover the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar rivers of Damascus better than all the waters of Israel? May not I wash in them and be clean?" So he turned away and went away in a rage. And his servants came near and spoke unto him and said, "My father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldst thou not have done it? How much better then when he saith unto thee, 'Wash and be clean'?" Then went he down and dipped himself 7 times in Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh came again like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and came and stood before him, and he said, "Behold, now I know that there is no God in all earth but in Israel. Now therefore, I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant." And he said, "As the Lord liveth, before whom I stand, I will receive none." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. And Naaman said, Shall there not, I pray thee, be given to thy servant 2 mules' burdens of earth? For thy servant will henceforth offer neither burnt offerings nor sacrifice unto all the gods but unto the Lord. In this thing the Lord pardon thy servant, that when my master goeth into the house of Rimmon to worship there, and he leaneth on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow myself down in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon thy servant in this thing." And he said unto him, "Go in peace." So he departed from him a little way. So we have Mr. Naaman here, a very important man with a very big problem. He probably had about everything he could wish for. He had fame, he had honor, he had obviously had riches. He was a looked up to man. But he had this horrible skin condition that was going to put him in a beggar's camp eventually if he didn't get it taken care of. This was before the days of lemongrass. He couldn't just run out and get a tub of healing elements balm and slap that on and take care of the problem. You know what I mean? He tried everything. He was likely second, I don't know if I could say second to king, but he was way up high. And he was going to be the lowest of the low if this wasn't taken care of. He was maybe even, some people think he was maybe second to the king. And it's true that leaders like this were very respected by the king. The king had a very big interest in keeping their army commanders happy, because it didn't take much for an army commander to get a lot more respect than the king, and they could turn on the king and take care of their king problem if they didn't like him. So he was very close with the king. So verse 5, we have Naaman headed to Israel. Since he was such a respected man, he went with servants, he had people, he had a company of people that went with him. And he was carrying with him money. He was going to put his money where his mouth was. If somebody can heal me, I will pay you, and I will pay you good. Some people estimate it's equivalent to $1 million today, everything he was carrying. Whether it was or not, I don't know, but suffice it to say, he had a lot of money with him. And he also had this letter with the king's credentials on it. It was very obvious he was an important man. And verse 7, he was really stressing this king of Israel out. Why am I expected to be healing this man? Am I a God that I can just take away a sickness like this? What are they trying to do? He was pretty sure Mr. Naaman was probably coming just for a good reason, that they could come back and trash the kingdom of Israel again, so that y'all didn't do what I wanted, so now this is a good reason to come back and take care of y'all again. Now put yourself in Naaman's shoes. He went with pure intentions to get healed. All he does is anger the king, and he's already a important man, and he's aggravating other important men. He's probably starting to feel a little bit, I don't know how he was, but I would start to feel just a little bit, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. Maybe that little maid back home is trying to get me in trouble. I don't know what all was going through his mind, but it's not hard to imagine he was starting to have his doubts. And he was a man that when he sent out commands, people would come. If he called you to come to him, you went. And here we have Elisha saying, "Send him to me." That's a little backwards. A little backwards for then. Naaman could have said, "Why don't you come to me, Elisha? I'm the important one." But we see Naaman loading up, and he's headed down what I picture a dusty dirt road to Elisha's little cottage. Now, it says he came in a chariot. I imagine he had a fancy ride. The other day I was driving through Ash Flat and I seen a fancy ride. I came up behind a Lamborghini of all places in Ash Flat, Arkansas. Now imagine in our world today, if a Lamborghini pulled into my drive and he had maybe a police escort. I don't know, that's kind of maybe the equivalent of what was going on here. It'd be a big deal. Now, he'd probably high center in my drive somewhere, and I'd probably get a real good look at his car before he finally got it dug out. But it made a show going out into the country. And he's going to all this effort, and verse 10, he gets insulted again. Verse 9 and 10, Elisha won't even come to the door for the man. Naaman goes up to the door, and Elisha won't even come. That's a bit insulting. I'm not even going to show you my face. Naaman already got dirty going back this gravel road, and now the man's not even going to come see me? And that's where Naaman's imagination nearly got him in trouble. Verse 11 says, "Behold, I thought." See, Naaman had this preconceived idea. He had heard about this God of Israel, and he just knew in his mind the way this was all going to happen. Elisha was going to come out, and he was going to strike his hand over the place. He was going to, maybe lightning would fall from the sky and wipe it off his skin. He didn't know. He had a preconceived, imaginative idea of how this was all going to work and how healing was going to take place. And he got disappointed time after time. And he was about to give up on this. He was a man of action. He didn't like quietly being told what to do. He would have probably done just about anything rather than go dip in the River of Jordan. He'd have probably rather Elisha would have came out and told him to run a marathon and do 50 push-ups and Robin Hood an arrow at 100 yards, all while quoting scripture at the top of his lungs. He would have probably rather done something, anything along that line, than go meekly dip in the River of Jordan. That wasn't what important men did back then. They didn't go dip in the River of Jordan just for the fun of it. He even mentioned several other rivers he'd rather dip in. Why the dirty old Jordan? In a way, you have to admire Elisha for not being starstruck by this man coming to his door. Isn't that amazing? If I would have been in Elisha's shoes, I would have probably kind of wanted to ease out there and you know, Naaman, here's what God told me, but you're not going to like it. And I'd have tried to prepare him mentally for what I was going to tell him and try to cozily get him to go do it. But Elisha's pretty harsh with him. I find that interesting. Not a lot of flattery words. Not a lot. It's pretty basic instructions. So we have this thing of preconceived ideas and imaginations. And they do get us in trouble sometimes. I see it in my line of work sometimes. Delivering sheds, people have a preconceived idea of how you're going to install a building when you show up at their house. Because of maybe their neighbor or their friend said how you did theirs. And so they have, in their mind, they have it all mapped out exactly how you're going to do it. And sometimes they're right. I'm happy to listen to them. But sometimes they're just wrong. That's not how we do it. You have a preconceived idea, and your way's not going to work that well. And there's times that I'm pretty sure I know how God is going to work in whatever area. Just pick an area in your life, and I think I know how God's going to do this. I know the best way for God to do this, and if God doesn't do it this way, I'm pretty sure he's not making a right decision. And when we run into those incidences, how willing are we to stop and say, God, it doesn't seem right, but I'm going to let you do it anyway? We've all seen people, I've seen people that have grown bitter at their Christian walk because they didn't think God was working the way that in their minds that they conceived he should. Naaman nearly lost the blessing from God because it didn't happen the way he thought it would. He came that close to going back home a leper. He almost walked off, and we would have maybe never heard about him in the pages of history. if he would have just been another man that didn't like the way God's plan of healing him was, because it didn't match what he imagined in his mind. He would have just been another one in the pages of... There's a long list of people, I'm sure, in pages of history that have been lost because maybe this very thing. But Naaman's servants came to the rescue, and he had a life-changing attitude shift. I love verse 14. When God does something, he does it right. Did you ever notice that? His flesh came to him again as a little child. A little child. You seen a baby's skin? No, it's clean. No pimple problems. No, it's just smooth and clean. It's amazing. That's how his skin was. He probably had, I like to imagine he had beautiful skin for the rest of his life. I don't know if he did or not, but. And verse 15, his gratitude knew no bounds. He was willing to unload all his riches in thanks for this. And did you catch that? He wanted to unload his riches and swap it out for 2 mule loads of dirt. He asked to take dirt home to build an altar out of to worship God. He's going to change his money for dirt. He was that grateful. Verse 18, just for whatever it's worth, some people view that as a bit controversial, maybe. Like, Naaman just came through this great conversion experience, and now what? He's asking to go into the house of, I think you pronounce that, Rimmon, which would have been a heathen place of worship. Why is he asking to go in there? I don't think Naaman was saying he's going to go in here. He had just got done saying God is the only God he's going to worship from this point on. I don't think he was asking to go in there and worship. I think he was saying sometimes his king or his leader goes in there, and he goes in there to physically help him. And sometimes if the man bows down, he may need to bend over and help him back up, and he's asking for permission to do that, not that he's bowing down to this in this heathen place of worship, but that he's actually physically helping a man. I don't know. Adam Clark suggests we should read that in the past tense, like he's asking forgiveness for the times he went in there before. But be that as it may, we see Elisha sending him away with his blessing. He said, go in peace. I think if he would have been asking to go in there and worship, I don't think Elisha would have blessed that, but I don't know, something interesting to think about. I find this interesting too, in Luke 4:27, it would say that Naaman was the only one in all of Israel in the life of Elisha that was healed from this dreadful disease. This Syrian captain, how about that? The only one. And it's because he was willing to let go of his imagined way of God's healing and let God actually work the way God was intending to work that he got healed. Isn't that amazing? So what do we do now with these imaginations that get us in trouble sometimes? I'll tell you a story of a man by the name of Frederick Gerstacker. Kind of brings out a point. Frederick Gerstacker, it's kind of a weird German name. He was from Germany, and he came over to the United States in the very early 1800s. And very interesting man from his travels all the way from, I think he started out in Canada, and he came down through the U.S., and he was in Arkansas a lot of his time. So there's a lot of, through his writings, we get a lot of how the history of how Arkansas was started. Anyway, very interesting man, kept a very detailed diary. And one night, he was in a camp with some friends in Arkansas. And his friend had a livid fear of snakes. And as you all know, Arkansas has its fair share of those. And there was, I think it was three in the camp, and so these two were talking about snakes, and it was nighttime. And Frederick decided, enough is enough. I've had enough of this snake talk. I'm going to bed. So he rolled up in his blanket and he drifted off to sleep. And he woke up about an hour later and he felt something move under his leg. And his friends were still talking about snakes over around the fire. And he knew in his mind it was a snake under his knee. And he knew that if he got up slowly and tried to creep away from it, it was going to get him. And he didn't know what to do. And his friends kept talking about snakes. And it felt it twitch again, and he knew it was a snake. So he did the only thing he knew what to do, and he burst with all of his strength out of his blanket and went roaring off into the woods. And the second he burst from his blanket, both of his friends burst out from around the campfire, and they all went roaring off into the woods. And they meet in the woods, and they start feeling sheepish, and they creep back to their campfire, and he goes over to where he was laying, and there was a little green twig sticking up right where his knee was, and it would just move a little bit. And they all felt rather sheepish, and they all went to bed and went to sleep. See what your imagination will do sometimes? We think in our minds we know what we know, and we know what's about to get us in that situation. And not only did it affect him in the way he thought, it affected his two friends too. It wasn't just him. We may think our imaginations only affect us sometimes, but they have a way of affecting the people around us and our closest friends especially. Have you ever had a problem with somebody? You know, they might have not been your favorite person to start with, and they didn't really do anything wrong, but, you know, we don't really click together. And before you know it, you can start forming a mental image in your mind about this person. And you can think of every single flaw in your mind and everything that they do wrong. And suddenly you can't find yourself hardly with anything good to say about this other person. And suddenly you realize you're the judge, and you've tried and convicted them, and you've sentenced them in your own mind. All in your mind. And then we suddenly find ourselves with massive amounts of problem against this alleged person, and it's all in our head. And if we're not careful, that's one of the ways the devil can start breaking up relationships. Don't let him do it. Don't let him do it, brothers and sisters. Don't let him do it. It all started with a little thought in our mind and a lot of imagination. And I know there's nobody perfect. Y'all can find all kinds of places to start thinking about me and my life like that. I'm sure you can. But we need to give each other the benefit of the doubt and don't build cases against each other in our mind. It's so easy for me to do because nobody else can look into my mind and see what I'm imagining about them, right? Or can they? We must give grace and not always think we know why people are doing what they do, because we don't always know the struggles the other people are facing. I've embarrassed myself in my own mind several times. You think you know why somebody does something, and you think that's why they're doing that, and it's ridiculous. They need to figure it out. And come to find out later, it was for completely different motives. And I started thinking in my mind, and before I knew it, I had them all convicted. I had it all laid out why they were so wrong, and it turns out it was completely the opposite. And it's embarrassing, but I found myself in that situation. Listen to this verse in Zechariah 9 and 10. Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, execute true judgment. Show mercy and compassion to every man his brother. Listen to verse 10. And oppress not the widow, nor the fatherless, the stranger, nor the poor. And listen to this last part. Let none of you imagine evil against his brother in your heart. That's a good place to start. Don't ever imagine evil against your brother in your heart. Listen to 2 Corinthians 10:5. This is the verse that I said gave us instruction in how to deal with this. 2 Corinthians 10:5, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing in captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Imaginations in that verse actually refers to arguments, or it's one of the thoughts behind it. Casting down every argument. He's telling us that if we're not what we're thinking in our minds, what we're imagining, if it isn't glorifying God in some way, toss it out. Get rid of it. Cast it down. Usually the things we treasure, we don't throw down. We put them in a safe place and we lock it up and we make sure it's safe. He's saying cast it. Don't do that. Don't lock it up in your head and mull over it. Throw it down. Proverbs 23 verse 7 says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Zig Ziglar had an interesting way of saying it. He called it stinking thinking. Don't do stinking thinking. God gave us these things called brains that are amazing, amazing. People study the brains. They try to learn how the brain works. It's a complicated mass of gray matter that we have in our heads. And we shouldn't take that beautiful thing God created and trash it with what Zig calls stinking thinking. God meant it to be used to bring honor to him. All right. In closing, the struggle, I haven't really had this struggle to a large point, but I have struggled in this area. But I hear people sometimes say they struggle with thoughts in their mind and it rolls over and over and they can't get it to stop. Now, I've not struggled with that extensively, but I have already had negative things in my mind I could not get out. So what do you do? I'm interested to know how y'all would, what do y'all do? How do you stop the cycle? I know what I have done, and I'm not saying it would work for you, but when you pray out loud, it has a way of when your ears hear what your own brain is thinking, it has a way of purifying your mind. And I would suggest if you struggle with that, try praying out loud sometime. I don't do it as much as I wish I would, but I have. Some, in my early morning quiet time, I can't hardly pray out loud. I'm going to wake up the boys, and then I'm not going to have any prayer life, right? But if you're alone somewhere where you're alone and you can, pray out loud. It's amazing what it will do for you. Don't be embarrassed to do it. There's times to pray quietly, and there's times to also pray where your own ears can hear what you're saying. And the other thing I would say is don't be ashamed to ask for help from others. I think I can safely say probably everybody in this room struggles with their mind and their imagination. It's a struggle for all of us. It is for me. And sometimes it does you good to just open up to other people about your struggles. Tell them, you know what, I'm struggling in my mind area, my imagination. Make your struggles known. I'll read in closing Philippians 3. Didn't put a marker in there, and now I'm having trouble finding it. I like this Bible, but it has very thin pages, and sometimes these little books are hard to find. Philippians 3. 20 and 21. For our conversation is in heaven, from whence we also look for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall change our vile body, and that includes our minds, that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body, according to the working whereby he is able even to subdue all things unto himself. So the challenge I want to leave with y'all is, we're still a work in progress, all of us are, especially in this thing of our minds. Don't be discouraged in the struggle of it, but have a goal of looking towards Jesus and being like he is in this area. It can be, it's a lofty goal, and it's one we'll never attain on this earth, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. There is a day that is coming, as Ernie had mentioned in his opening there, that he will change this vile body so that we may be fashioned like his, if we're faithful. Don't forget that. All right, that's all I have. Why don't we kneel for prayer?